is side two of tape number 370, January the 5th, 1979. The Assassination Information Bureau asked the various researchers, the seven researchers, the next question, or this was one of the main questions: what mistakes or omissions did the House Select Committee make? And Jerry Polakoff said Dr. Humes was not asked questions about the autopsy, that was the most serious mistake, that they had Dr. Humes on the stand. He was only on for 10 minutes, and they didn't ask him proper questions about the autopsy of John Kennedy. The second answer to that, Jerry Polakoff had five remarks on this. He said they failed to test bullet 399 to see if it could emerge pristine. They ignored Oswald's New Orleans visits with David Ferry, Carlos Brunger, and Warren DeBries. And they're going to suppress all immunized testimony. And then he went on to say that they went after all the critics using the umbrella man with an attitude of, let's get the critics. Well, I agree that they should have asked Dr. Humes more questions about the autopsy and about a bullet that was handed over by him that was in John Kennedy's body. And another researcher talked about that. And they didn't test bullet 399, that's true. Again, with Oswald's visit to New Orleans, I think the as important as visiting with David Ferry and Carlos Brunger, who both were with the intelligence community, and Warren DeBries at the FBI, I think as important as that would be to go into the area of the Guy Bannister, Albert Osborne, New Orleans connections, also the Clay Shaw connections to the World Trade Mart, and also the Bunge Corporation, which has its headquarters in New Orleans, that was named in the book Were We Controlled as being knowledgeable of the assassination. And that has its headquarters in Argentine, and also would have something to do with the Alexander Zeiger Argentine Marina Oswald Minsk radio connections. I think that that triangle, the Gary Powers U2 part, was completely left out intentionally, because that, again, is getting up the ladder to 7 and 8 if we're going from 1 to 8. Those are the very top of the questions to be answered, the last questions to be answered, or if it was reversed, the bottom line. But building up as a pyramid, those are the areas that were ignored. As far as the umbrella man, David Lifton said they made a mistake by using the umbrella man to get the critics. But the point is that the umbrella man, according to Richard Sprague and other researchers, Richard doesn't believe it was the umbrella man. He doesn't believe it was the same umbrella. It has a different handle, and it had a different amount of spokes. There was no one to corroborate that he, in fact, was the person that was there. And Richard Sprague feels that they substituted somebody. And it wasn't so much that they're trying to tease all the critics, because Bob Cutler's talked about the umbrella man and written books about the umbrella man. And they laughed and made that the most comical day when his umbrella pops open and everyone gets hysterical. But the point is that before Senator Church's committee, they demonstrated that an umbrella is a weapon and that it has been used as a weapon. So there wasn't anything funny about that. The same man that talked about the umbrella as a weapon should have been called in, and they should have handled it as seriously as they do other information. What mistakes or omissions did they make? David Lifton said the medical evidence was restricted. Dr. Humes could have told all. I think the omission also has to do with Postmaster Holmes and the reception of that rifle, testifying about the rifle that arrived in Texas, Dallas, Texas, that was supposed to go to Lee Harvey Oswald's box. I think that was a serious omission. I think the medical, Jerry Polakoff mentions it, David Lifton mentions it, Sylvia Marr says. She says the very cursory interrogation of Dr. Humes, I think that's the single most scandalous and outrageous element of the House Select Committee. Well, there was a cursory examination of Gerald Ford before the House Select Committee. He was called before them, and there were documents of his. I have them. The committee knows about them, that when Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission, he not only was attending the Bilderberger meetings the same time, simultaneously, that were going on in the United States that year as a member of the Bilderbergers, but he also had documents from the very first meeting that Lee Harvey Oswald was in the FBI, and that he also was in the CIA, and he had his CIA number. And I think that's a cursory examination of Gerald Ford, who was there. I think it's equally as scandalous and outrageous as having Dr. Hume. There also was that cursory examination of Marina Oswald, which was outrageous and just as bad as Dr. Hume, because Lee Harvey Oswald didn't have a rifle. He never received it at the post office. And yet, in the Warren Commission volumes, volume 10, page 400 and 401, there's testimony or an affidavit signed by Wesley Liebler with Glenn Emmett Smith, dated April the 1st, 1964, 1 year after Lee Harvey Oswald had gone from Dallas, Texas, New Orleans. And it's about a man named Robert Taylor who worked at a Shell service station just blocks from the Payne's home, Ruth Payne's home. And Marina Oswald moved in with Ruth Payne April 24th, 1963. Lee Harvey Oswald went down to New Orleans April 24th, 1963, and Marina Oswald moved in to the Payne home April 24th, 1963. And Mr. Taylor received a rifle at that home while Oswald was down in New Orleans in exchange for car lubrication. And Mrs. Payne and Marina Oswald were there and gave him this rifle. And he went on to work for the Dallas Police Department. And that man should have been called as a witness. And I think that the most outrageous thing was not the direction of the bullets or the way they even handled Dr. Humes, but the fact that Marina Oswald was on the stand and was never asked the question point blank, did you hand a rifle over to a Mr. Taylor in Irving, Texas, from the Shell station? Did you see him? Or to call Mrs. Payne as a witness. But they had Jerry Ford there, they had Marina Oswald, and they did not ask those questions. And a rifle that was sent under the name of A. Heidel was in the Texas School Book Depository, or one similar, and Marina Oswald used that name, forged that name, was caught writing that name, and she was not asked any questions about the rifle. And without finding out if the rifle was planted on Lee Harvey Oswald, it doesn't matter whether the shots, the policeman, Dallas policeman, hears, picks up on his tape four shots. And this new committee says one shot missed and didn't hit anything. We don't know where it went. It didn't hit anything. Three shots came from Lee Harvey Oswald. He did all the shooting. He's still guilty. He's still the only, there's a conspiracy, but he's the only man that fired a rifle. And this is not true because he didn't fire the rifle, and the rifle was planted. And it was transferred. And Sylvia Maher is back saying, I think the single most scandalous and outrageous element was the interrogation of Humes. So that you have a clear-cut demarcation of the kind of research that I do. It's Mae Brussel versus Sylvia Maher. I think the most outrageous and scandalous element was, number one, the handling of the neutron tests of the bullets, using different bullets, admitting that the brains of John Kennedy were missing and therefore they couldn't relate what bullets went through that brain to the fragments they were testing, using different bullets than they used in 1964 and not telling where the old ones went and how they got the new ones and why they didn't use the same ones, and not producing the conclusions of the neutron test that J. Edgar Hoover did in 1964, the neutron test, and the examination of Marina Oswald and of Gerald Ford, to me, were the most scandalous and outrageous elements. And that's where I differ with Sylvia on that subject. The next answer, Sylvia continued to say that they gave Marina difficult moments. They never challenged her regarding the Walker shooting or the attempted shooting of Richard Nixon. And they never questioned how she got FBI agent Hostie's license number or address, which was literally impossible. But if Sylvia Maher wanted to find out how a rifle went from the Payne home where Marina was staying, then the answers would be solved as with regard to the Walker shooting, that Lee Harvey Oswald, in fact, hadn't seen the rifle because somebody picked it up at the post office, and there was a lot of evidence that he didn't shoot General Walker. The whole case could have been thrown out if they had stuck with the order by which the rifle changed hands. Harold Weisberg was asked the question, what mistakes or omissions did the House Select Committee make? He said they never addressed the evidence in the body of the case, which is true. But that's like saying the Warren Commission didn't. He said their medical evidence was dishonest. Dr. Bodden was a liar. He said, I will call him a liar and he can't sue me because he lied about his testimony. And then Harold said the two fragments of bullets found by the FBI in the front of the president's car, unless these two bullet fragments came from the same bullet, then on this basis alone, the total official story is false. Now, Harold Weisberg is right. He's starting with the very beginning, point one, Dallas, November 22nd, 1963, or when the Warren Commission started in January 1964. If the bullets are not coming from the same bullet, then everything else is false. You can't argue with that. But at the same time, this House Select Committee took bullets out of the National Archives, and they tested them, and they admitted that they were bullets that were different than the ones tested before. They admitted the brains were missing and never called the witnesses to find out the chain of command of taking care of the brains of the president that were to be examined for purposes of solving a crime. The John Connolly clothing had been removed and destroyed and dry cleaned. The car is up in Dearborn, Michigan, and they didn't ask how in the hell it got to the basement of the Ford Motor Company. It was Henry Ford who funded Adolf Hitler, one of the first people, Americans, to be overtly responsible for helping Adolf Hitler create his army and his tanks and cars and so forth. The car is in the basement up there, and nobody asked how it got there or why it's there. And the location of bullet 399 was never identified, even this committee. The capability of doing the damage was not tested, as mentioned before. So we have all of this information, but we've had this since 1964, and I think that they should be not reiterating as if they're starting like newborn babies with a new committee. They're doing the same work they did back in 64. It's like Martin Lane going to the Boston Conference in 75 and setting up a blackboard and a pointer and giving a talk about Helen Markham and the grassy knoll. The same talk he gave at Beverly Hills High School in 1964, he's giving in 75. There has to be something wrong with these people. There absolutely has to be. And if you meet them and confront them, you'll find out. If you ever get a chance to correspond and say, what gives with you people, they should be outraged at the job that G. Robert Blakey did and Chairman Stokes, but they're all very cozy and they're very satisfied and they can continue to do some more books and articles without ever letting you get to the surface until you have General Haig as President of the United States. And then you won't be able to ask these questions. I assure you, you won't be able to ask these questions. Now, Harold Weisberg talks about fragments that were recovered, copper-jacketed fragments, and they were numbered Q2 and Q3. But he says Q3 had no lead core material, and Dr. Gunn is an expert on copper jacket material and limited his questions. He's right, we should stick with the evidence, but he got along quite genially or quite smugly and just said, well, they're not doing anything. But that doesn't solve the problem. Paul Hawk was asked, what mistakes or omissions did the House Select Committee make? And his first suggestion was that they failed to press Dr. Hume on the autopsy of John Kennedy. And then he came his second suggestion, which I hardly agree with, but which Paul Hawk would never sit down with me and develop at any point, is they failed to pay attention to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was framed. Now, we know Lee Harvey Oswald was framed when you see the picture of him with the, holding the rifle in the shadows. And when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, he said, I'm a patsy. And Paul Hawk says his circumstantial case against Lee Harvey Oswald. And that's true. They failed to show how he was framed. And there is circumstantial case that they've developed against him. In volume 22, page 376, there's a note in Seth Kanner's notebook that the first tip-off that the rifle came from Klein's in Chicago, the mail-order rifle, was from a North Carolina preacher who called up and said, go to Klein's in Chicago. Again, the preacher, the church, the World Council of Churches, the Torbett document talks about the church being one of a five-part prong of Permandex. A preacher from North Carolina says, get the rifle. It's at Klein's in Chicago. Why didn't they look into the tip-off of the gun? Why didn't they identify where the bullet was found in Parkland Hospital before the doctors go into the long story of how this bullet could go through John Kennedy and John Connolly and then end with the wrist of John Connolly, and they didn't follow it through to the thigh and the stretcher. Why didn't they find out whose stretcher it was? Because a bullet 399 wasn't tested and couldn't do the shots, and if it was found on John Kennedy's stretcher or some stranger's stretcher, not John Connolly's, then all the medical evidence is a bunch of bull crap. Should I say bullshit? That's all it is. I can say it because we're off the air. These are private tapes. Excuse me. The planted negatives that were found, the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle. See, Paul Hawk says that Oswald was framed and they didn't pay attention to it. And then on the other hand, he says they did an excellent job with their scientific evidence. What about that picture of Lee Harvey Oswald holding the rifle? What about the testing of bullet 399? What about the testing the weapons of killing Officer Tippit? The bullet holes in Tippit didn't match the pistol that Lee Harvey Oswald had. Why not press the handwriting experts and do some scientific work on the handwriting that ordered the gun at Klein's or the pistol out in California and Marina Oswald using the signature of Heidel, or going into the use of the doubles of Lee Harvey Oswald, totally left out of this investigation of the people impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald. The CIA has voice prints of Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico at the Cuban embassy that they wouldn't produce, that would show it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald's voice, probably that the person there that was setting up the storm wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. So what Paul Hawk says, the AIB, is that they failed to pay attention to the fact that Oswald was framed and that there was a circumstantial case. But on the other hand, he says their scientific evidence was excellent. And yet, if they used the scientific evidence, it would prove beyond any doubt that Oswald was framed, and yet he leaves that open. And then Paul Hawk said they left out the Dallas involvement of how Ruby got into the basement. Well, I don't think it's so important whether Jack Ruby went down the ramp or whether he came in a door that was supposed to be investigated that nobody investigated, or whether he got out of a green car that was parked in the basement. The important thing is, who is Jack Ruby? Jack Ruby's contacts, as I say, to Bertha Cheek and Earlene Roberts, Ruby's contacts to the Dallas Police Department, his contacts to Warren Carroll of the CIA, Connie Trammell, the Young Americans for Freedom, the German marksmen that were brought over here from Germany, and I'll have to do one whole tape for you on that, and his contacts with H.L. Hunt, and also Billy Del Mar, the hypnotist in the nightclub. At the time, just before John Kennedy was killed, Ruby closed his club when Kennedy was killed. Billy Del Mar fled and was never interviewed. And Jack Ruby had been hypnotized and told he would be a hero by the CIA and by Warren Carroll, once in a lifetime, be a hero. He thought he would be great if he killed this person who had killed President Kennedy. And also he knew David Ferry, the hypnotist, who also was an expert and doing scientific work on experiments with cancer and mice and cancer. And, you know, Jack Ruby died of that three-week cancer, although they had probably developed in better laboratories than David Ferry's apartment. But the point is that they left out, according to Paul Hawk, the Dallas involvement of how Ruby got in the basement. And where Mae Brussel differs with Paul Hawk is that they left out all of the links of Ruby. In the past, he was an informer for the FBI, the House Security Committee, when Richard Nixon was running the House on American Activities. He worked with the CIA. His connections in Las Vegas with organized crime that worked directly with the Central Intelligence Agency, that's what they left out, not how it got in the damn basement. Pardon me again, but it really disgusts me how primitive these people are and pass themselves off as experts. It's not how he got into the basement. It's the story of who Jack Ruby was and who he knew and how he was used and then how he died and what he tried to tell the Warren Commission, and they passed him off as being an idiot. Bernard Fensterwald was asked, what mistakes or omissions did the House Select Committee make? And he said, there are two things. They permitted the FBI and CIA to dictate who they could have on their staff, and they did not use their subpoena power towards the executive branch. Now, there's a contradiction here, and this is an interesting comment coming from Bernard Fensterwald, who works directly with the CIA He was James McCord's attorney, and he's now representing another family from the CIA, widow, the gentleman that was found drowned. She now believes it was a double. He's the attorney for that case. Works with the CIA all of his life. There's a contradiction here. A, if Fensterwald's right that the FBI and CIA dictated who they could have on their staff, then why in the heck would they use their subpoena power towards anybody? The purpose of their dictating is to control the witnesses. Once you have your staff set up, it goes without saying that they control the witnesses. So that's a contradiction to say that they could dictate who the staff was and then expect them to subpoena anybody. And then at the last minute, he says, they made a mistake by canceling Sylvia Duran's testimony. This is what he says. Well, Mae Bressel differs with Bernard Fensterwald about the omissions they made. I again say, what about Robert Mayhew from the Howard Hughes organization that had been the hidden branch, the open defense intelligence CIA branch of the CIA since 1947 when it started, but the hidden CIA assassination since 1950 when Mayhew made, 1960 rather, when he made his overt greetings from the intelligence community, from the Defense Department and intelligence community to organize crime. Robert Mayhew is alive and could be called. What about the omission of Ruth Payne? Because, number one, there was a rifle at her home. There were allegations of a rifle at her home. And also, she is the woman that called Roy Truly and got the job for Lee Harvey Oswald in the Texas School Book Depository and placed him in the building. I'm sure that he was part of the conspiracy. He wasn't innocent, and he expected to be a decoy and to be released, and he was framed. But if Ruth Payne was asked the question, did Lee Harvey Oswald get in your white station wagon when a car honk that Sheriff Craig said happened, then Lee Harvey Oswald is alive and the double is dead, and that omission goes into not exhuming that body that I've talked about, that grave in Texas, where the Warren Commission said we have to destroy that body and cremate it because the nation can't stand another shock. Ruth Payne should have been asked about the rifle. She should have been asked about the station wagon, and she should have been asked under oath and been given a sentence of perjury if she lied, because they could also exhume the body. They should have called General Walker in and asked him about assistant Mr. Duff, who went to New Orleans, and that's very important, the man that disappeared in Oklahoma. General Walker should have been asked, was Jack Ruby at your home at any time? Can you tell us anything about Jack Ruby? And they should have had Ruth de Morenschild, who claims that her husband was a Nazi agent, that he worked for the CIA, because she said she saw a rifle in the home of Lee Marina Oswald, and that rifle, because it was in a closet, doesn't necessarily mean it was fired at all, but she saw a rifle that Marina showed her in April, before the de Morenschilds went to Haiti and before Lee Harvey Oswald went to New Orleans, because that could have been the rifle that went with Marina to Ruth Payne's house. It is absolutely verified that the rifle couldn't have gone from New Orleans, from Dallas to New Orleans in the baggage that Lee Harvey Oswald had in the size. It couldn't have gone from New Orleans to Mexico. It didn't go back with Marina's possessions from New Orleans to Dallas. So the point is that Marina Oswald, in April of 63, Easter time, showed Jean de Morenschild one evening in the back bedroom. She took her in there. It was late at night, and the de Morenschild had awakened them up. She took her, opened a door. There was a closet. This is the only person, only living person, who's supposed to have seen a rifle that could have belonged to Lee Harvey Oswald anywhere near Lee Harvey Oswald from the time he left the Soviet Union, where Marina said he belonged to a rifle club. And this woman, Jean de Morenschild, was not allowed to talk about, because if Marina got it from a post office box and had it in a closet, and Mrs. Payne picked her up on April 24th, the rifle could go to Payne's house with Marina, where Mr. Taylor picked it up, and that was the rifle that was found behind the boxes at the Texas School Book Depository, without palm prints, without fingerprints, without any link, hair, or fiber to Lee Harvey Oswald, and his paraffin tests were negative. These were the things that should have happened. So when Fensterwald says that they canceled Sylvia Duran's testimony. We're back again at the Warren Commission level, at a very unsophisticated level. The things I'm talking about are things that I cross-filed and researched after the Warren Commission was over and spent 8 years cross-filing those 26 volumes. They could have called Roy Truly as a witness because he had German Mausers in the Texas School Book Depository, and Lee Harvey Oswald talked about them, and that's in the 26 volumes. And also I mentioned it in the People's Almanac, the new volume 2 of People's Almanac. Lee Harvey Oswald talked about other Mausers in the building, and the first gun was supposed to be a German Mauser. Roy Truly is alive, and he wasn't called, and Eugene Brading of Organized Crime, who was at the Dow Tech building, who was at Dealey Plaza, did not have public testimony. See, these people were being interviewed about the public testimony because we don't know what went on behind. And for all I know, Warren Carroll of the CIA, who wrote Lifeline for H.L. Hunt, that was partly played by the Rockefellers, that newspaper that went out called Lifeline. The script of Lifeline was on the car of Jack Ruby's, Be a Hero, Once in a Lifetime, Be a Hero. Warren Carroll worked for the CIA and had the papers that were telling Jack Ruby to be a hero and take this great courageous stand, stick out once and do something of great courage. Warren Carroll wasn't called. Now, Division 5 of the FBI, that's written up in the Torbett document, headed by William Sullivan, of course, they must have an intelligence branch now. William Sullivan died just when the committee was doing their work. I'm sure he wouldn't have been called. And Albert Osborne is dead. But somebody must know about Division 5 of the FBI, about the counterintelligence school, the school for assassins down in Oaxaca, Mexico, and somebody from there should have been called. They asked Carl Oglesby, what mistakes or omissions did the House Select Committee make? And Carl Oglesby said their mandate was to review the record. Its purpose was not necessarily to find the final truth. In solving the case, its purpose was not to defend the official theory of the lone assassin. Blakey started out this at the outset with only one side as a prosecutor against Lee Harvey Oswald and Chairman Stokes as the chairman owed it to the Congress and the country to offer Oswald's defense. Now, what these people have done that I've named for you from called Seven Serious Critics, what they've done with the Assassination Information Bureau that Penn Jones has referred to as being part of the Central Intelligence Agency themselves, they've given you the most elementary, infantile conclusions that maybe, if you don't know anything about assassinations before and not much about the Warren Commission hearings and the Warren Report is out of print and the 26 volumes are not available and you don't have the time and patience to read them, they give you the most superficial cover-up the second time around. And for somebody who's done the amount of work that other people like myself have done, or just speaking for Mae Brussel, it's offensive to see these people personally, to meet them, to hear what they say, and to see the way they cover up. It's true that Blakey, at the outset, started as a prosecutor against Oswald, but they all knew that. Every single one of these people knew within a week when Blakey was hired what he was going to be. And they should have gone to the Justice Department or Congress and said, stop the money, stop the hearings. I was saying on tapes and radio all along, it was nothing but a cover-up. It should never be started with these people doing the investigation. They never proved that Lee Harvey Oswald shot anybody. They never produced the original autopsy x-rays. They never proved that the bullet went through John Connolly to that stretcher or could have gone from his thigh to the stretcher. They never proved that the bullets that they had were consistent with the bullets, the fragments that came out of Lee Harvey Oswald's weapon. They never explained why they used different bullets. They never convinced the public at large that the fatal headshot came from the behind and not over from the front. And they never convinced in this work that Oswald fired a rifle as fast as they said he did. They were able to speed up this rifle now and make it work faster than it did before. And this was apologized by one of the critics by saying it's been tested so many times it works faster. The fault with the second layer cover-up goes into who was selected to do the work and the apologists that were their advisors, who sit back and now just come out with these asinine explanations of the errors of the committee. The errors of the committee go beyond Dr. Hume. They go beyond even this tape of the police recording, because they still end up with Lee Harvey Oswald doing the shots and the other bullet going astray. They say there was a second gunman at the fence, but he missed. Believe me, if they went to the bother of having a conspiracy with a second gunman there, he was an expert marksman. He was able to get away from the Dallas police, the Secret Service, the FBI, not be apprehended, not being recognized. He knew how to shoot, and he certainly didn't miss. And if he shot, where did it go? He didn't miss. He hit the head of John Kennedy. And these people think it's a great feat that the sound shows four bullets, instead of being angered at the story that the fatal headshot came from behind. Many of you have that position paper I wrote September 17, 1976, 2 years ago, when the House Select Committee was going to do their investigations. And I predicted many of the errors that they have been making and made. And I knew 2 years ago clearly where they were going. There was no excuse for what they were going to do in 1976. It was obvious. And I said that new panel that's going to be selected is already bowing down to the same pressures the Warren Commission had. This gives you a very brief analysis of the difference between where this is going and who's covering up, and how Mae Bressel feels as against these other critics who are speaking up for the critical community, and they certainly are not speaking up for me. It's very important to ask why in 1978 they still hold such primitive and elementary conclusions when there's so much more information leading to the conspirators, and as I say, our time is running out.